It is a real honor for me to ask these questions today. Dr. Stein and I have taught together for 16 years, and I want to say personally, he's had a remarkable influence on me, and I've always been struck with your godliness. You have been a good and steadfast, godly example to me.
So well, you can fool some of the people all the time.
So I'm going to ask questions for 30 or 40 minutes, and then I'm going to give you an opportunity to ask some questions at the end. So Dr. Stein, begin by telling us about your family, where you grew up, and just so we can get to know something about your background.
My mother and father were immigrants from Germany in the early 1920s. My dad was in his early 20s. My mother was 16 when she came to America. They met here and married. And as my older brother words it, he says he was the firstborn, and they were very disappointed when he was born. But despite this, they would try one more time. But after I was born, they quit totally. And there were no other offspring that way. My mother and father are not the kind of people you would write a book about. They were hardworking people who saw in America the hope that by hard work they could make a good life for themselves and for their children. They were from Germany. They were not the kind of people that would keep telling their children or often tell them that we love you, but you knew they did because the way they acted, they cared for you. I knew I was, nothing could ever interfere with my relationship with mom. I always had a home, always had a place to come to. They wanted their children to be educated. That was something they didn't have. It was highly esteemed by immigrants, and they did without things so that we could be educated. My mom probably had not even a junior high education, and my dad had about that. But then they raised their children. One became a lawyer and the other a theologian, so they did educate their children and instill in them that kind of thing. So that are not educated, but they had a real wisdom. You and I both know people have PhDs and have all this education, but are just dumb. My mom was a real wise woman. She was very astute, had that kind of wisdom that that godly people had in general. And again, her piety is not the kind of piety people would write about, but it was a love and concern my parents had for me.
Your mother lived into her 90s.
She died this past summer at the age of 95, and I remember she was a very strong woman, and I often thought she'd be would have been a great pioneer. Perish the fact that anybody would ever try to hire their children, they'd be in real trouble. She would, I have nothing but great memories of my mom and dad.
Well, when did your father pass away?
He died in 1980. He had Alzheimer's, and I remember mom taking care of him, sleeping on a couch next to his bed. And I worried that she was going to kill herself because of the demand on her, but she loved her Willie, my dad. And you know, some people would say, well, why do you do that? And she wouldn't understand that. It was just that kind of thing that when you married somebody, you loved them and you took care of them, and she was a great wife, great mother.
I'm sure you could say many things to this, but is there something in particular, looking back, that you learned from your parents that was particularly helpful?
There's one thing I always remembered. In 1945, after World War II, my dad got a letter from a soldier, a corporal in the Army, who had been part of a team that visited the home of my grandmother in Germany. After the war, an officer would take an enlisted translator, an enlisted man who understood German, and he'd go from house to house asking if they had weapons or something, because the war was over and they had to turn these in. And when they came to visit my grandmother, my grandmother said, two sons in America, and showed pictures and addresses. But there was no fraternization allowed, so the officer ignored that. But when they left, he said to the corporal, he said, you go back and find out about that. And so we got a letter saying that I visited your mother, and if there are any things that you want to send to them, to her and to your brothers, send them to me, Arthur Devlin, I still remember his name, and I will see to it they get these packages. So from then on, my parents began to prepare 20-pound parcels of powdered sugar, powdered eggs, powdered milk, buttons, needles, clothing, basic antibiotics, toothbrushes, and so forth. And they had the advantage that they could send it to Arthur Devlin because there was no allowance of that in the rest of the by the government. There was a it was only about 2 years later when there was a lot of lobbying by German Americans that was now open to anybody to send packages. So, but with Arthur Devlin, we began that. I remember we had a hallway, and there were always packages in various stages of completion, 20-pound packages. And when they were complete, they were wrapped in brown paper. I remember the string around it, and they would have these labels on it to Arthur Devlin, so-and-so in Kassel, Germany, and he would bring these parcels to them. And after the last day he was there, apparently he got five or six of these parcels, and he borrowed a Jeep right away and made one last trip out to my grandmother and uncles and brought these there. And when he returned to America, my dad and my uncle, who did the same, asked him if they could do anything for him. They would like to do something. And he said, no, I just wish if it were my mother, someone would do it. And that was it. But I never forgot his name, Arthur Devlin. But I believe my mother and father sent something like 900 packages of 20-pound parcels of clothing and all this. Sometimes the new antibiotics like penicillin, which were not available in Germany, they would send out. And when I was on a sabbatical in 1975, Joan and I visited my uncle and cousins out in Kassel, and they treated us like royalty. They couldn't, that was 25 years later, but they couldn't do enough for the son of Willie and Ella Stein. I still remember that, yeah.
When did you come to faith in Christ, and could you describe to us what happened?
I had attended Rutgers University for the first year. I lived in West New York, New Jersey, or West New York, New Jersey, as I would have said back in those days. And after my first year, my dad had changed jobs, and he moved to Hawthorne, New Jersey, and started to attend the Gospel Church in Hawthorne, New Jersey. And the result of that was that I was in an area where I didn't know anyone. I didn't have a friend left during my between my freshman and sophomore year at college. And one night there was a youth rally at that church, and mom and dad said, well, why don't you go take the car and enjoy yourself and go. And I went, something with hesitancy, but although I had come from a church background, I didn't know the Lord. But I met some friends there that night, and Barb Brower and Larry Grove befriended me, and I didn't have any other friends in that area. And so I would do a lot of things with them, and through their influence and the influence of the church, I remember August 15th that year, kneeling by my bed and inviting Christ into my life. And
was that your freshman year?
Between freshman and sophomore, yeah, after my freshman year. I didn't say anything to my mom or dad about it, but about 3 days later, mom asked me what happened, because she saw the different kid, different son at that time, had a joy, a peace about me, kindness and love that I really didn't have before. So that was the turning point in my life. It was in August, and then I went back to Rutgers in my sophomore year and became active in InterVarsity, and that became the single greatest influence of my life at college, my relationship with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. I was a chemistry major when I was converted, and after my sophomore year, I switched to pre-med and went to summer school, took biology. But my my relationship with InterVarsity gave me ideas of wanting to go on to study more. I got to the place where I really didn't know who. You hear different things about what the Bible means, and I finally said, I have to learn how to interpret the Bible for myself. So InterVarsity was very useful that way in my life, and I also then went to for help, what seminary do they recommend, and one seminary that my church recommended, which was a gospel dispensational church, they recommended that seminary, and then InterVarsity also recommended Fuller Theological Seminary, so I applied to both. But with the first one, very quickly I ruled that out because I found that you had to be a pre-tribulationalist and a premillennialist to graduate. And I said, well, I'm a post-tribulationalist, and they wrote back a letter saying, well, we still want you to come. We think after 4 years here, you'll believe the way we do. And they didn't realize how that turned me off terribly. And so I went to Fuller Theological Seminary. It was a good choice. They had great faculty at that time. It was a great school.
So how did your parents respond to your faith in Christ?
They were happy about everything but my baptism, because the baptism as a believer seemed to be an insult to what they had done when they had baptized me as a child in the Evangelical United Brethren Church in Union City. And I eventually didn't talk anymore about it. I just was baptized by the church, and they were there. And but later on, they were all very positive about it. But that was the only incident that was somewhat difficult, because it looked like a rebuke on them, and I didn't intend it that way. And sometimes as a young Christian, you're not as tactful and sensitive as you might be. And maybe I was trying to argue theology. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah. You brought up Fuller Seminary. Do you have any recollections that you'd especially like to share about your time at Fuller? Is there anything that particularly comes to your mind?
I remember my first days at Fuller going to a druggist and saying, I think I'm sick. I can't breathe here. And they said, oh, you don't live around here. And I said, no. I said, I just moved to the area. He said, that's just smog. But theologically, I think the single greatest influence of Fuller was taking George Ladd's class and reading The Blessed Hope, Crucial Questions on the Kingdom of God. And that really was one of the foundational works that shaped my theology. I still hold on to, and I think he was right on, that the kingdom of God is a present and a future reality, and the way to understand the word kingdom is a dynamic term, the rule of God, and that allows it to be present and future. And that really settled me eschatologically that way. It was very helpful that way.
What advice would you give to seminary students today, especially seminary students just beginning their education?
I think you have to realize that if you're going into the ministry, you're giving yourself to a life of study. You're not going to stop studying when you graduate here, so don't enter the ministry. My goodness, please don't. You're entering into a life of study and training for the gospel ministry. So that when you leave here, there'll be seminars that you'll be attending. There'll be all sorts of conferences you'll want to go to. But you have to realize that there are a lot of good conferences out there, but there are certain areas you're not going to have the ability to get conference and further training in. For instance, there are very few seminars out there for intermediate Greek grammar, and there are very few out there for the history of the Reformation. Most of it deals with the practical areas of ministry, and that makes sense. The result is that if you don't get the classical disciplines down, if you don't get grounded well in theology and church history and New and Old Testament and the languages in seminary, you're not going to be able to do it later on. It's your only chance for those areas. So that I would tend to say, make sure you concentrate on those things you're not going to be able to get later on. Get the what we call the classical disciplines down real well. I also worry a little about the direction of church leadership. When I was at seminary, we talked a great deal about the role of the shepherd. I don't know if we think of ministers as shepherds anymore. The model seems to be more of a business CEO of management. And I worry about that. I worry about losing contact with the people and losing the understanding that you're really their servants. And something I think in the practical areas of teaching, you have to work on that area. I know you need to have the skills of a CEO to run a church in many ways. But if you're not their shepherd and pastor, when it really comes to important things, when you lead them through the valley of the shadow, when you help them grieve over the death of a lost one, I think you're not going to have quite the ability to minister to them than if you've been shepherding them all those years. So I think that's fairly important. I think one other thing I would suggest, and that is that while you're at seminary, that you don't join into some system of theology or viewpoint very quickly. This is really a time of gathering information and letting that brew in your minds. And as time goes on, a system will develop. But I worry about people who come already with a system of theology and they're not open to let the text speak for themselves anymore. And we begin to force texts into meeting our particular system of theology. And I think that's dangerous. I think it'd be much better to try to remain open and acquire this information. And as time goes on, when you have more understanding of it, then I think you build a system out of that. I know some people would object to that, but they're wrong.
Let's back up for a minute and tell us how you met Joan and something about your family, your children.
Okay. The most important decision I ever made in life was to accept Christ on August 15th in 1953. But the second most important decision was my marrying Joan. In my first year at Fuller, a number of friends there came from the University of Nebraska. And during a spring break, they had known somebody who was with them at the University of Nebraska in the University Christian Fellowship, who was teaching in Whittier, California. And so one day we went down, I think it was to Knoxbury Farm or something like that, and on the way home, they decided to visit her at school. And as the class was leaving one door, we walked in the other one, and I met Joan that way. And kind of just blossomed that way. There was some event coming up in the church that I needed a date for, and I thought this is the opportunity, so I invited Joan. And by the end of the freshman year, we were very seriously talking to one another about our future and whether it involved each other. That summer, I returned back to New Jersey and worked most of the whole summer at the Billy Graham Crusade in New York, and we corresponded by mail. And when we got together again in September, when I went back to school, it got very serious. And I had some friends at church. They had kind of adopted me when I went to Calvary Baptist Church in Pasadena. They were Grandma and Grandpa Ford, who were my grandma and grandpa, and Virginia McClellan, a widow who lost her husband on D-Day in Normandy, and she was Mom, and Liz was Sis. And so I had my second family, my original family in New Jersey, and this adopted family. And I remember talking to Grandma, Grandpa Ford, and Virginia. I said, well, you know, John and I are getting very seriously, and what do you think of Joan? And they just raved. She's a great girl. Can't go wrong. And then at Christmas time, I introduced her to my folks. We flew to New Jersey, and Mom and Dad loved her right away. And what was very interesting was my brother and sister-in-law, who were not Christians, they loved her right away. And that was a good sign. So I proposed that Christmas time, and we got married in June of the second year of my seminary training. And the only regret I have is that we didn't get married at Christmas time. She's been a real sweetheart, love of my life, a real partner in life. We had, after graduating from seminary, a church didn't immediately open, and when it did open, it opened in January, and the place was North Dakota. First thing I did was look up North Dakota in an encyclopedia and found out that in 1936, they had their record high and low. The record low was 60 below, and their record high was 120 above. And I thought, well, this is an interesting state, the difference between steam and ice you can have. And we were there for about 4.5 years. We lost our firstborn son, Robert Paul. That was a great tragedy. First time I really encountered grief. It was an experience that God used in helping me that way, to help others in grief.
Did you lose him at birth?
3 days later, yeah. And what made it really tough was that it was touch and go. Born Wednesday, touch and go. But Friday, the doctor said, I think we're over the hump. And we hadn't called up our parents because we didn't want to say anything. And said, everything looks pretty good now. And at 3 a.m. Saturday morning, I got a call to come down. And that made it harder. And then Joan had 2 miscarriages after that, after a few months, and that made it hard. And we were well into an adoption proceeding when Julie came along, and she was born in North Dakota, our daughter. And then the next 2 years later in Boston, in Massachusetts, our son Keith was born, and then in New Jersey, Steve was born. So. And they're all married. I have 11 grandchildren. They all married in the Lord, and they're all raising their children, very active in their churches. Julie and her husband are missionaries in the Ivory Coast. Great kids. God's been very good. I think it's probably because of the way their mother raised them. She did a real good job.
One of your sons is teaching at Bethel College now.
Yeah, Keith left working for the Army in Natick, in Massachusetts, and came to teach in the physics department at Bethel. Steve works for 3M and is very active in his church, which is the church you were a member of.
Right, right. So you alluded to this. You were in pastoral ministry four and a half years,
yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like to say to the students in terms of advice regarding pastoral ministry and your experience as a pastor? You already mentioned.
Yeah, there's one thing I did on the advice of Clarence Roddy, who was a professor at Fuller. And that is, every time I worked on a sermon, I didn't work on Sunday's sermon, but the following Sunday's sermon. In other words, I always work 2 weeks in advance on a sermon. And I never in all those years ever came on a Saturday night where I didn't know what I was going to preach. I always was prepared. And I would be preparing this week, for instance, not for Sunday's sermon, for the next Sunday's sermon. And I would be able to mull over what I was going, any changes I wanted to make. But it gave me a tremendous ability to be at rest, and my mornings were always for study and working on sermon preparation and things like that. But you know, I really believe the Holy Spirit knows 2 weeks in advance what you should preach. Just the practice of having in hand the sermon for this week already, that gives you a great deal of freedom and ease and not worrying. And that was something that I did all my pastoral ministry was very helpful. I would many times before the year began, I'd plan out my sermons for the year. and get that organized and leave some blanks for certain kinds of occasions that might come up. But working a week in advance was really very, very helpful, very practical. I recommend it to you. It saves a lot of nervousness and worries about what's coming up this Sunday.
I think you were in the pastorate 4 years, and then you began to feel called to study. I think students would be interested in knowing how that transpired in your heart. How did you begin to sense that you should go on for further studies?
Yeah, as I was working in the church, I noticed there was one particular group that I worked very well with, and that was the high school, college age students there. And I enjoyed working with them. I enjoyed teaching them. And I thought, I wonder if this is an area where God has perhaps gifted me and I should think about more fully. And I did want to study. At seminary, if someone said, are you going to go on to a doctoral degree in New Testament or something like that, I'd say, you're out of your mind. I didn't have the faintest idea of going on a further education. But as I was teaching and preaching in church and studying, I began to realize I really want to study more fully in this area. And the result was that after 4.5 years there, we left and went back to school. We went to Andover Newton Theological School, which was a Baptist school. I was an American Baptist at the time. I knew it was very liberal, but I wanted to study and see what liberalism had to offer. Learned a lot from it. I went with the impression that I was somewhat of a narrow-minded fundamentalist bigot, but I had the truth at least. They might be more liberal and open-minded, but they didn't have the truth. I came away realizing that I was a narrow-minded fundamentalist bigot, and I had the truth, and they were narrow-minded fundamentalist liberals, but they didn't have the truth. That the fundamentalism in that kind of sense of being narrow-minded is not a property of an evangelical position, it's a mentality. And that was a real interesting lesson. They prided themselves in being very concerned about ecumenicity. But when Billy Graham came that summer to Boston, and you had the most ecumenical Christian service in the whole community, the Roman Catholic Archbishop was urging people to go to attend this. So you have the Roman Catholics urging people to go, and you have all the other Christian groups, but Andover Newton Theological Seminary didn't exist. And so they had a particular kind of ecumenicity, and Billy Graham's didn't fit that. So it was very interesting that way.
You did your THM there.
I got my THM there, and then I went to, I applied to a number of schools and was accepted at Princeton and one other of the four, but I chose Princeton. And it was the right decision again. I don't know why they accepted me. They were only three accepted that year, and but I was accepted, and it was a great experience. Had great professors. Bruce Metzger was one of them. My doctor professor was Bertolt Gärtner, who came from Sweden and later was the bishop of the Lutheran Church in Göteborg. The only Lutheran bishop who greeted Billy Graham when he came for a crusade in Sweden, and then J. Christian Becker, and brilliant mind. So I had really a superb trio of professors to study under.
Yeah. Anything about those years that particularly strikes you that you'd like to share?
I remembered once talking to Bruce Metzger and asking, it was a reception for the new students, and I asked him, well, Dr. Metzger, when you write, do you write a book and when it's finished you go to another book? How do you do that? And he kind of just smiled and he said, well, Bob, I'm working on 5 right now. And I was wondering, what am I doing here? Should I leave? But I stuck in and hung in there. Was impressed by the brilliance of Becker. Dr. Becker had a brilliant mind. Metzger was brilliant, but he had a breath. He was the kind of the Renaissance scholar. It was in everything. And you'd read things that he'd written in areas, you know, how in the world did he ever write on this area, something like that. Becker was the precision of thinking in Pauline studies. I was always impressed by that. And Gertner was a Scandinavian, brought that with him, and introduced me to studies in redaction criticism. And it was in doing a paper for him on Willy Markson's De Evangelich Marcus, the Evangelist Marcus, Mark, that I got my dissertation theme, and worked. It went smoothly and well. I was very pleased how things went in that program. Delighted. They were very good to me. Great library. And in the when I was just about to graduate, I asked to meet with the president. Met with him and thanked him for that. And I remember his saying, "You know, Bob, the real key in theology is your presuppositions on the supernatural. So that will determine where you go." And he was right on.
I want to give you time to ask questions. I'm just going to ask a couple more. I'm just going to select a couple that I have. Yeah, any books, after your, in light of your 30-plus years teaching, any books that you think would be particularly helpful for students to read?
Well, even though it's still difficult, I think of E.D. Hirsch Jr.'s Validity and Interpretation as being a real classic. Changed my life, and it wasn't that I didn't believe this or I was radically in a different direction, but it clarified for me what I was really trying to do when I interpreted biblical texts. He was very helpful that way. Another work was Hans Frey's The Eclipse of Biblical Narrative, an even more difficult book to read. I don't know why they write. There are a lot of English books I wish were translated into English. These are difficult books, and I wonder why they're so difficult, whether their brilliance has gotten in the way, or whether they are really writing for the reviewers of their books rather than the people who are going to read them.
That seems to happen quite a bit.
Yeah, it really does. C.S. Lewis's article on fern seed and elephants, that was a life-changing article when I read it and realized that there was no way that you really could understand what an author was thinking when he wrote unless they say it expressly. If they never guessed once right with regard to why he was writing, how will you ever deal with somebody 2,000, 3,000 years ago? And that was really, gave up what we call the study of the mental acts of, and looking at what we have, and that's the text and what they mean by that text. That was very helpful. Yeah.
My last question, when you look back over the evangelical movement over your career, and you see where evangelicalism is today, what do you think is the most pressing issue, or perhaps the most pressing issues facing evangelicalism, and what is your assessment of where evangelicalism is? I know that's a huge question, but maybe just a little slice of an answer.
We've come a long way. I mean, when I went as a seminary in the late 50s, there were very few good books written by evangelicals. I mean, if you looked for texts, the texts were always non-evangelical. There just wasn't much out there. There were some attempts by, you know, E.J. Carnell was writing some things, and so was George Ladd. But we have come a long, long way. When you look at commentaries today, a lot of the best commentaries are evangelical commentaries, and I think even the critics would acknowledge that a great deal. So I think we've come a long way in bringing up the respectability of the evangelical movement. I think that people can't just laugh off evangelical scholarship like they once did. In some ways, however, I think in doing that, we have reached out very broadly, and the definition of evangelical is much more ambiguous than it was in the 50s. And there may be people who like to be in the evangelical umbrella, but whose views are really less determined by evangelicalism than a kind of a baptized critical approach to things. And I worry a little about that. I worry about the hermeneutical issues that are coming up. When people no longer are concerned with the authorial intent of what the author means by these words, then I think that the doctrine of inspiration is rather irrelevant, and there's nothing objective out there at all anymore. So I think that's a real danger that we're facing.
Great, thank you. Well, I'm going to open it up. If you would like to ask any question to Dr. Stein, this is your opportunity. I see Jim Hamilton there.
Yeah, the question was, I had made some comments for suggestions for people who are studying here in the pastoral ministry track, but what about those who are planning to go on into education? What recommendations do I have for them? One of the things that I think we have to be open to is the realization that there's a lot of good truth out there by non-evangelicals. I've learned an awful lot from people who are not evangelicals or reading their books. And in fact, they've challenged me. And when I look at those who have been most influential, most of them, and again, I remember I was talking about the formative years of my training, and there was not as much out there among evangelical works as there is now. So I think you need to be open and not simply write off somebody who doesn't fit the parameters that we have of inerrancy and so forth and so on. I think you can learn a lot from others. And I would worry about, we interviewed somebody recently for a position here, and questions were asked as to what books were influential for them, and they mentioned a number. And then I asked, what non-evangelical books have influenced you? And the answer was not that clear. I've learned a lot of things from non-evangelicals. Willie Markson, for instance, denies the resurrection. So in my understanding, I don't think he's a Christian at all in that sense. But he was right on when he talked about understanding the gospel traditions in the light of three distinct Sitzumlebens: Jesus, the oral period, and the evangelist. And I don't think we have to be frightened to accept that part of his teaching, even though in other areas he's radical and we don't accept it. So I do think we need to be open to what we can learn from others and not simply write that off. I think, again, I would be concerned about when you look at the biblical texts, that you make sure you allow the biblical writer to speak what he wants to say, and not look at the biblical text and say, how am I going to fit this in my system? Hold off on the system, or at least allow rough edges in some of these things, and let the text speak for itself. And as you wrestle with that, I think then we'll make some real worthwhile advances in the faith. Even Calvin, for instance, in his commentaries, don't make his commentaries fit his systematic theology. Sometimes he leaves things the way they are because he doesn't want to force that text to fit the system.
Yeah. Right. I've always appreciated how Dr. Stein has, in seminars, colloquia, has pointed me to the text of Scripture. Mm-hmm. Well, next question. Feel free, don't be shy. Yes.
Dr. Stein, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how it came to be that you came to Southern and what Southern has meant to you.
I was enjoying my years at Bethel Seminary very much. Got a call from Dr. Moeller, who asked if I'd be willing to consider the possibility of Southern Theological Seminary, as was a position open here. And I said to him, I really was not interested in any move at this stage of my life. And he said, well, would you be open if the Lord led you this way? Well, how do I answer something like that? That was a loaded question. And I said, well, sure. I mean, I don't want to preclude what God might be doing, wanting me to do in life. And then he said, well, I'll have Dean Akin call you and talk to you about this. By the way, my wife began to dislike Dean Akin very much. As soon as she heard him on the telephone, she wanted to, it's for you. Because she knew then the dean was trying to talk me into coming here for an interview, and she was very happy, and all her friends are in Minnesota. So I did agree to come down, and what excited me was that I thought for a long time that the Southern Baptist Theological, not just this seminary, but Southern Baptist seminaries were in serious trouble. We had interviewed a number of graduates from this very school at Bethel, and in Old Testament we were looking for some, and they were so radical, and they had this, they could talk about revivals and things like this, but that was simply the remains of the flower, but it had been cut off at its root, and the evangelical roots were all gone. And so I thought, if there's not something that happens among Southern Baptist seminaries, I worry about what would be the future of the denomination. When I came down here, I thought, well, maybe I could do something in this area. I was especially interested in the fact that they wanted to organize a basic required course in hermeneutics. And for me, this is very important. I think it's crucial for a seminary education. And the very fact that what I thought was crucial, they thought was very important, they wanted to do, gelled right away. The joy of, you know, the ability to teach doctoral students was exciting to me and the like. So there were a number of things like that that were very interesting. I don't think any of you realize that 5 to 10 years before I ever came here, I was interviewed at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And everything went very well until I met with the faculty, and the only issue we talked about was the women's ordination issue. And on that issue, since I believe that there was the role of the head pastor was not available for women, I was blackballed by him on that. And so it was very interesting. When he talked about the situation now on that issue, the reverse was true back then. And it was rather interesting. Now.
Yes, way back.
I often thought if I didn't spend time in the pastorate, I could be that much further ahead as a scholar. But I'm awfully glad I did spend my time in the pastorate. I think that was very helpful for me. I think it gave a dimension to my teaching, which was always very practical, church-oriented. How does this affect the congregation? How can we share this with the people in the church, rather than simply being theoretical? So I wouldn't change that. I don't want to sound that sometimes my wife and I suggest maybe we could have done something different if we had raised the children when we raised the children. And I say, I don't want to change anything, because if you change the mix, it would change the possibility. And I'm so delighted with what God has done in their lives. I don't want to change it. And I think I'm pretty much that way in my life. There are flaws and things I've done that I regret. But in general, I would just say I wouldn't want to change it. If I had to do all over, I would want to do what I've been doing now. I couldn't be more happy with the years I've had in teaching. It's been wonderful.
Yes.
I don't sense myself as being an expert in that area. I really don't. Most of my study of the Bible and my devotions are associated with that. My prayer life is many times in various areas. There was one thing that at seminary helped me keep my feet on the ground. At Fuller, I don't know if you, when you were there, they had a day of prayer. Every semester there was one day that was a day of prayer. And the first semester, first quarter I was there, I went to all the meetings of the day of prayer and found that all they were doing was yelling at me why I didn't pray more, and I wanted to scream and say, if you guys would stop telling me, give me some time, I'd pray. So after that, every semester was a day of prayer. All I did was devote that day to reading my Bible and praying and meditating. I wouldn't do anything associated with my schoolwork. And those days helped me with regard to the danger of the sterility of a seminary. And it's there, but that one day of prayer was a day that I reserved for Bible study and prayer. That was very helpful for me. But I have no, quote, discipline that I could pass on. I can't write a book and say, do the steps to great holiness, because then it wouldn't be an autobiography anymore. There are other people I can talk about that better than I can, I think. It is.
Yes. Alberto.
Behind every great man, there's a great woman, and how does my wife fit into that? My wife has been a teammate with me all my life. I've often said to her, and I'll say it publicly, although the books bear my name, it really should be Robert and Joan Stein, because without her, none of that would have happened. She's really a lot more intelligent than I am. I'm not joking about that. She's really a bright gal. But she didn't go. She got a master's degree. She didn't go on to a PhD because we had children, and she devoted herself to that. And I said to her, the greatest accomplishment, and there are a lot of women have all sorts of degrees and books, but you just point out your three children and what they've become and who they are, and you have all sorts of grounds to be proud. And there were times when she would work while I was going to school, and we've never gotten through my education without her financial ability as a teacher. There were other times when we would kind of reverse roles at Andrew Van Newton. She was teaching out at grade school, sixth grade, and at night, because of her work, I would take care of little Julie if she woke up. And it gave me a close bond with my daughter. But she's been just sweetheart. In the commentary on Luke, I also dedicated that as well as the first book to my wife. And I included the prayer of Tobias when he marries his wife, where he says, Lord, grant that we may grow old together. And God's been granting that. It's been very special. We're close friends. Romance is still there. In many ways, warmer than ever. And I worry a little about the fact that I'd rather take out my wife alone and be with her than to do things with other people. It's almost antisocial, but we enjoy each other that much. It's going to be tough when one of us dies. But I've told her that the agreement is I die first.
Yes, Bill, fun.
From the very beginning, I always thought that I wanted to interact with people who did not necessarily agree with me. And I always wrote not treating them as enemies, but somebody I was trying to win. And that's important. I think a lot of times we evangelicals treat our opponents as enemies rather than friends. And it doesn't mean we agree with in the sense that way, but treat them politely. And I've learned a number of things. For instance, I remember getting a letter from somebody who had just read my book on parables, and he'd asked if there was anything else I had written on parables, because they were doing a doctoral dissertation on that. He was a Jesuit priest studying at the Papal Institute in Rome, and he ended his letter saying, "I want to thank you for your reverent treatment of the Word of God." And no evangelical had ever said that to me. And somehow, I think if we don't unnecessarily offend people like that, we may be able to interact with them. And some of the nicest letters I've ever gotten have been from Roman Catholics. Joel Marcus wrote me a nice letter on an article I wrote. I think if we write with love, with conviction, and if our arguments are sound, it may be that we can reach out and bridge some gaps that normally we don't think we can bridge.
Yeah. I remember reading, before I met you, a review of your book on parables. I think it was in Expository Times, and the scholar said it was an excellent book and you're a master teacher.
question. Again, you can just convince some of the people all the time.
David. Yeah.
Well, let me just explain that this summer we are moving back to Minnesota. My two sons live there permanently with their children. My daughter will be home on furlough with her husband and the three children, the grandchildren. And so all my children and the 11 grandchildren are, for the next year, going to be in Minnesota. And Joan and I had always told Joan that we would retire in Minnesota. So this summer we'll be moving back to Minnesota and selling our home here and buying one there. I will continue to teach here next year. I will commute. And in the fall semester, I will commute, leaving Monday, flying Monday nights down here and leaving Thursday afternoon, late afternoon back. And the second semester, spring, I'll be flying down here on Sundays and flying back on Tuesdays. So I will continue teaching. I love to teach. I still think I can teach to a certain extent. Do you know the greatest teacher that I had ever heard a lecture was E.J. Carnell? Huh. When I was at Fuller, people would stand up in the whole lecture because there were no seats to hear him. 2 years after I left, the gift was gone. He became very introspective, morbidly so, and students fled his classroom, fled his classes. They just didn't want to. And so at this stage, I still think I can teach and contribute. I like to do that. So I'll be teaching here one more year. Then the main thing I have to do is complete my commentary on Mark. I've said I would do that. I'm in the middle of that. It's going to take a lot of time yet, but Lord willing, it'll get done before he returns.
Last question.
You can fool a lot of the people by acting.
How did God work that in your life, and what recommendations or warnings would you say to this body of students?
When you get to know the giants, you realize how little you know. When you sit next to a Bruce Metzger or a Christian Becker or a Gertner, when you read Raymond Brown and hear him speak, and you really have contact with the giants, it doesn't take humility to know they're in a different world than you are. They're just, they're gifted in ways, and you're really a real small fish compared to them. It doesn't take any genius to do it. It's not a spiritual discipline. You just know enough to realize that there are a lot of people that are a lot smarter than you are. And that causes you to be humble. When I graduated, I didn't have my dissertation published, but I got 4 articles out of that. And I had one published by JBL in America, one by ZNW in Germany, one NT in Holland, and one New Testament Studies in England. So I had only 4 articles written, but I had been published in 4 countries. That sounds real good. But ZNW, when they wrote back the acceptance letter, and it was addressed to the Reverend Herr Dr. Professor Robert Stein. And I thought that would really impress my wife, but she just kept calling me Bob, and that's all.